One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Welcome to episode 25 of Blue Jays Happy Hour. We are back after an extended hiatus. We're back after a moderate hiatus. We appreciate you guys tuning back in. And since we were gone, Stoughton, it seems that Canada's team, the Atlanta Braves, has won the World Series.
Yeah, I heard about that.
It's an interesting discourse right now. A lot of people looking to heap praise on Alex Anthopoulos. That is nothing new.
And as they should.
As they should. You know, congratulations are in order. It's tough for me to get too invested in the idea of, oh, they've got Soroka, they've got Freddie Freeman, they've got Alex Anthopoulos. Therefore, this is a team that we should be behind, especially in the context of all the Tomahawk Chop stuff, which has slowed down in any way. And in fact, a former president came by just for some performative racism.
Yeah.
A guy from New York who's now like a swamp person in Florida came by to a state that he lost just to show that he was racist. And when that happens, it makes me feel less enthusiastic about the Braves. Also, just not a great team. They picked up some guys that really panned out. And I think there's a lesson to be learned about not giving up, and you miss every shot you don't take, and you got to give Anthopoulos credit for taking that shot. But I don't know. The whole thing left me feeling a little bit empty. I don't know about you.
Yeah, I've been trying hard not to like antagonize the gloating Anthopoulos stands, because you know, have your moment, whatever. Great for him. You know, nobody ever disputed that he was good at his job. I think the Blue Jays are in a great place. I don't think we need to worry about where the Jays are or pine for Alex and think, oh, he's some wizard who did the impossible. Cause like you say, it was, he did what he had to do, got the team in, had guys sort of hit on their peak performance at the absolute right time, which is how you do it. Like the Dodgers are like fully optimized to win every year and quite often don't, as we saw. So yeah, that you know, I have no dislike for Alex. He was on my former podcast very graciously, which was weird but also very cool. I'm also where you're at with the chop stuff. I find like not to say that it's not bad, but I also thought that like just the way that the broadcasts emphasized it and like just you don't have to show that. Also, like, you know, if they want to have their little racism party there, I don't know, you don't have to like,
yeah, you don't have turn to the cameras in. On the
yeah, and that was almost as, you know, egregious to me as the chop itself. Not quite to that level, but it did not feel great. But also, the Astros winning wouldn't have felt great. The Dodgers, the Trevor Bauer signing team winning wouldn't have been great. The Red Sox, you know, they're almost the best option out of them, which is crazy because they're the fucking Red Sox and they can fuck right off, and also had their own little situation with the Apple Watch and whatever. A lot of tainted teams out there, except the one I support, which is the only good one. Yeah,
yeah. There's only one good one. 29 bad ones. Yeah, I would have been okay with someone out of the Central, like the White Sox, if they had come through. I think I would have been generally okay with that. Maybe there's something horrific that I'm missing there. Apologies,
Tony La Russa.
But yeah, Tony La Russa. Yeah, I mean, there's landmines everywhere you go.
It turns out, yeah.
The Brewers, I think, would have been cool again. I don't know, Josh Hader landmine if you want to go there. Yeah, I don't know. I found myself less excited about this World Series than most of them. However, I do find myself excited, and I try not to get up too much for prospect stuff that can get out of hand, but it's hard not to get excited about Gabriel Moreno right now, which has to be sort of the biggest story in Blue Jays land. This guy, I know. I mean, I think we expected
this
him to go
fucks.
To
yeah.
This guy's sick. No, we expected him to go to the Arizona Fall League and kill it. 55 plate appearances, you know, 372, 472, 605 slash line, 10 walks against 6 strikeouts. You know, he very briefly tested AAA and didn't really do much, but he was incredible at AA. We wanted to see him bounce back from that injury. It's safe to say that he did. And yeah, I don't know. I think it's going to get people talking about that timeline heading into the season, because my presumption was that heading into the season, the general consensus and understanding would be that this guy's going to start at AAA and like, let's let him ramp up the free Josh Tolley situation for a little bit, especially because the Blue Jays have solid options in place. And I don't know if this is going to change any of that. We're talking about, you know, 50 plus plate appearances at a level where the competition can kind of be up and down. But I'll tell you that sort of the chorus and the pounding of the drums for Moreno is going to increase in a way that maybe the Blue Jays didn't predict coming into the 2022 season.
Yeah, probably. Though, I mean, I don't know. I think at his end of season presser, the Zoom call that Atkins did, he, you know, was asked about catching depth, and he did sort of suggest it might be too soon for Moreno the start of next year to be with the team, but didn't say no to that either. And as we'll all hear later on, I believe one of your over unders was that he would show up in 2021, which if he hadn't broken his thumb, could have happened. And like, you're right about the varied competition in the AFL. Like, that's always, I mean, I remember Keith Law for years banging that drum, like, don't scout the stat line anywhere, but especially like the Arizona Fall League is, you know, there's some great prospects and there's some guys working on stuff who just need extra, you know, they're not necessarily big. It's not like he's doing this against big leaguers. He's doing it against guys who knows what level they'll be at next year. But putting some good swings on the ball, absolutely, and, you know, throwing guys out and just doing everything that he could possibly do. Also sort of in a vacuum a bit, right? I think of a lot of the other top prospects that were supposed to be there, people thought were going to be there or were slated to be there, got hurt or pulled out or are not there. And so he's like the guy farthest up the top prospect lists who is there and is looking exactly like a guy who should be right at the top of everybody's top prospect list.
Yeah, I mean, he's about as exciting a position player prospect as they've had. I mean, obviously, since Vladdy's not a period of time, but if you could sort of erase Vladdy and
yeah,
from history, maybe even erase Bo too, that like weird cohort that rarely comes around. But if you kind of think back into the 2010s, into the 2000s, you know, Travis Snyder was there, but there's not a lot of guys who are at this level.
Yeah, he's in that conversation, absolutely, which is crazy and amazing. Like, you know, he might be the best catching prospect in the division, and the Orioles have, like, the number one overall pick from 2019, also a catcher. So, yeah, it's very, very interesting. It's going to be interesting to see what they do, because they obviously have that depth there. They have some luxury. I can't remember if I was writing about this or just talking to somebody about it, but it's like, you know, if you keep all three, McGuire, Jansen, and Kirk, into the season, like, does that make you have to wait too long to bring Moreno up? Like, because it feels like he's not a guy that you need to wait until July at this point. Like, I don't know if opening day is the thing, but, you know, if you go with the other three, or two of them, obviously, without, you know, trading one to sort of open up a spot for him and wait until like the deadline to move one, if that's what your play is. Are you wasting bullets by not having Moreno up sooner? I mean, obviously injuries can happen, and you know, the Jays obviously are big believers in having that depth, but also, you know, Kirk's an interesting trade piece. Maybe not as I think I saw Kevin Goldstein talking about, you know, not particularly enthralled with any of the other Jays catchers anyway. So maybe the industry isn't as high on Alejandro Kirk as, you know, the as like Jays fans are, which I think would probably be understandable. But still, there's not a lot of catching out there on the free agent market or just in general. So the Jays are going to be looking for ways to get better. And that's perhaps one that I think a lot of people have identified early.
Yeah, I think in the offseason, they would probably be wise to trade one of their guys. And by one of them, I mean Jansen or Kirk, because in my view, McGuire has no value whatsoever.
Correct.
I'm not saying that they get a huge haul for them, but like you said, you're kind of, I know injuries can kind of strike and any sort of depth problem you think you have can go away very quickly. But at the catching position, it's not quite the same where you can put the guys in other places. Like there's just less flexibility there, and a problem of a pileup is actually a problem, especially when you have a guy potentially as good as Moreno. So I wouldn't be shocked if they did that in the offseason at some point, even if it's not a massive, massive return. Blue Jays love Danny Jansen. I got to think that there'd be some teams out there that feel, you know, his bat really came around, his defense is good. I'm not saying that teams are necessarily in love with him, but I bet you that there's a couple teams that would see him as a potential starter. You know, Kirk is an interesting, divisive guy, but again, it only takes one or two teams that see him in the positive light, right? Like the whole industry doesn't have to think, oh, this guy's a stud. Just one or two teams have to sort of have that vision, and I could see that with Kirk or Jansen.
Yeah, I think that's right, and also other teams are going to see Moreno is there, and they, you know, they know that the Jays are not going to have these same four guys in a year. That seems unlikely, because he's just that's his job. He seems like he's that good, just based on, you know, again, just looking at the swings and everything, and not trying not to scout the stat line, but just all that you read, all the, you know, the scouting reports. I think Josh Norris from Baseball America, or maybe Baseball Prospectus, I apologize, I forget which one, was like some of the best reports he's ever seen on a guy. I've been on Moreno, and he's maybe, you know, the high guy at his outlet, because obviously there's going to be varied opinions. And I posted that, and somebody in my comments was like, has he been like, where was he there when Vlad was around? Because I can't believe that Moreno would be getting higher reports than that, or, you know, Wander Franco exists. So maybe it's hyperbole. I don't want to put words in his mouth or anything, but that's what he tweeted. And yeah, it seems like it's coming true. And like you say, I think it doesn't have to be a huge return. I mean, I think that obviously you want to get the best return you possibly can, but even just thinking about the roster, like Moreno in AAA and Kirk and Jansen in the big leagues versus Jansen and Moreno in the big leagues, and you turn Kirk into a reliever, even like a good one, obviously, but like that would be a better use of resources, I guess.
Yeah, it'd be the type of thing that maybe could make a one-game difference over the course of a 162-game season, which is the sort of thing that I'm sure we'll be saying quasi-snarkily about a variety of different transactions over the course of this offseason.
Turns out it matters a lot. Yeah.
Couple of sort of small Blue Jays bullet points. I don't know if we have to dig too deep into them. The Steven Matz qualifying offer discussion has been sort of floating around.
For lack of anything better to talk about.
My belief is that in theory, like that amount of money Steven Matz could return, but that's kind of the top end of his value. You'd be buying sort of the height of what he could conceivably do. There's a lot of pitching out there. The Blue Jays love flexibility. It's just those, all the factors coming together, it's really hard to see a situation where they could or should make that offer.
Yeah, I don't think they can do it. I mean... It's just too much risk. You can't pay Steven Matz $18 million, I don't think. I don't think the market is there for him, and I don't think the...
I don't think it should be.
Yeah, I like I was looking
great
at
Keith season, Law's, to be fair. Better than some people 100%.
Realize. 100%. Like, Keith Law, and I like, there's, you know, there's predictions and whatever out there. Keith, the other day, I was reading his top 50 free agents thing, and I think he said, like, I don't know, average annual value of $9 to $10 million for 3 years is probably... where he'd go with Matz, and it's like, yeah, that seems about right. And I think I mentioned in a piece this week, John Becker had him maybe a little bit higher average annual value, but it still ain't $18 million. And just the bounty that is the potential draft pick is just not good enough for the risk of tying up that much of your payroll into Steven Matz, who deserves a guaranteed rotation spot somewhere. Obviously, a pretty good big league contract. Had a great year. They like Matzy, but yeah, I don't think you can offer him the qualifying offer unless, as I've said every time I mention it, unless you know he's not going to take it. But I don't think that's how those things work.
Yeah, I think he'd be foolish not to take it. Recall that Marcus Stroman didn't take one last season. I know that's a very different pitcher and very different situation. Or did take it last season? Mm-hmm,
yes.
Very different picture,
took one as well, I believe.
Different situation, but again, that just gives you a sense of the quality of pitcher who is willing to take that, and Matz is below that quality of pitcher.
Yeah.
Other bullet points, you know, what we missed while we were away. There's the Marcus Semien, Scott Boras thing. Right. People want to make something of that. He's got new representation. Getting the guy who gets guys a lot of money when you're in a position to get a lot of money seems like a smart business decision on his part. Totally supportive of that. Boras is obnoxious. Boras has a lot of analogies that don't make shit for sense. But he gets people money, and Semien wants money, and that's all fair. And in a post-Ryu world, I just don't think the Blue Jays-Boras storyline is worth anything.
Yeah, I agree. And I don't know, like, does anybody think, like, that you're going to get a better deal if Semien had a different agent? Like, he's going to get paid. It's, you know, it doesn't really matter who's getting the 10% or whatever. But I, you know, you're right. I get it, because it does, he is obnoxious. And he is also sort of a, you know, famously, doesn't necessarily push guys into being hired guns, but just definitely like chases the biggest dollar, which is maybe interesting because, you know, so many people and such are the story about Semien's free agency has been like, oh, he really wants to play shortstop. He really wants to be on the West Coast. I hear that like every time his name comes up, it's like, oh, you know, the Giants, you know, have a lot of money now with Buster Posey retiring. Maybe that's a fit, but also they already have a shortstop. But, you know, people are really sort of hung up on the Bay Area thing, and maybe that's a signal that that Semien is less so than we've been led to believe, because, you know, I don't think Boras is not a guy who's like, I'm going to negotiate with two teams in your preferred state. It's taking as much out of the market as possible, and good for him, he should.
Yeah, Semien does feel like a bit of a Giants guy, but that's that's based on nothing and very nebulous. And he'll probably end up chasing that money.
I would love to see it. That's just an inoffensive setting for a guy I want to cheer for.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
great ballpark, going up against evil-ish Dodgers, et cetera, et cetera. Before we get to Ben, I think that is about it. We could talk about the CBA and the off-season game pushback. I'd rather avoid doing
time,
that.
I think
that there's going to be plenty of time to talk about that. I'm sure that will be a focus of a lot of stuff we talk about in the future. So on this episode, we have some other real content. So, we'll leave you with that. And we're going to bring on Ben. We're going to talk about the over-unders we did earlier in the season, or not earlier in the season, during the season in June, about a third of the way through. Some of our predictions, our abilities to tell the future. Spoiler alert, not great. So let's hear from Ben Nicholson-Smith now. We are joined by Ben Nicholson-Smith, MLB editor at Sportsnet.ca. Our longtime listeners, who were there since more or less the beginning, will recall that we brought Ben on, and we did a various, we did make various predictions about the future, which is rarely advisable, especially if you hold yourself to account, which is what we're going to do today. We're going to circle back on some of our predictions, mostly in the form of over-unders, and see how well we did. I don't know if I want to give the game away, but the reality is not great. if we could tell the future effectively, I don't think this is the business we would be in. I think we would be on Wall Street and or Bay Street making ludicrous amount of money, which none of us are. So bear that in mind, but we're going to take a look at some of these over-unders.
It should be fun, and it's so humbling to be reminded of just how wrong we were in so many different directions, but it happens like every time I make predictions, and I do, you know, as both of you guys do as well, I try to hold myself to account, like even in my, I write a bold predictions thing every year at Sportsnet, and I always have the previous year's, you know, results in there, and man, it is a reminder that, yeah, this game is just so hard to predict.
This game, anything, you know, the course, yes, of human society. There's not a lot of things that are easy to predict. So we had a couple of different categories. One of our categories was Vladdy. To be fair, I'm not proud of the predictions. I will say that I am a little bit proud of some of the lines that I set. They ended up being pretty close to reality. So the over-under I set for Vladdy's home runs was 44.
Wow.
He ended the season with 48. Both Ben and I had the under, and Stoughton, you get the first victory lap for
what?
The over. You
I
took the over on 44
over
home
on
runs.
That.
Yeah, it was pretty bold, to be honest.
That would have made no sense. Yeah.
Yeah. I think Ben and I were trying to build in a little bit of regression, I guess, for Vladdy. And he did have that rough patch, but the reality is, for the vast majority of the season, he was, you know, if not the best hitter in baseball, damn near it. And he was consistent, and he didn't miss games, and he hit 48 home runs, which is pretty hard to believe still, even looking back on it.
I mean, that is a great prediction by Stoughton to take the over there. That's pretty bold. I mean, I think, you know, going into the year, his career high was 15. So, I mean, you know, Nick, you set a good over-under there, a very aggressive one in hindsight. Like, I can't really fault you or me for taking the under on 44.
I was clearly just trying to manifest it, I suppose.
Successfully. For some context, we did these over-unders in June. So we were a third of the way through the season.
Okay, that's a good reminder.
I believe at the time he had something like 20 home runs.
Right.
So that's why the over-under was, I think it was based on the most aggressive projection for him. But even still, like you say, Ben, we'd never seen anything like it. He still had that ground ball tendency a little bit that worried you somewhat. And that's just a lot of home runs, to be honest. 44 home runs is a lot, and he cleared it by a pretty decent margin.
And there was the health question, too. Like, you know, he ended up playing in almost every single game of the season, but we couldn't have really known that. And especially after, like, I keep thinking about the fact that, like, his offseason was so grueling last year, where he was just working so hard, trying to get into that shape, lost a lot of weight. And then to sustain that kind of effort level, we saw him slow down a little bit in August, but he really rebounded and finished really strong.
So the second over-under for Vladdy, there was a whole Vladdy category, because I think at the time, you know, we were still in amazement of that, which is not to say we shouldn't still be in amazement of him. He's an incredible player, and his breakout was outstanding. But I think that at that moment, that was kind of the story around the Blue Jays. And this over-under was WAR, Fangraphs specifically. That's just my flavor. Everyone has their preference. And the over-under was set at 6.9. He had, I think, about 3.5 at the time. And we all took the over, all three of us, and we were all three of us wrong. But the final number was 6.7. So the line was right on the money, essentially. I mean, you could have argued there wasn't much upside with the over. I think we were kind of feeling that Vladdy wave cresting, and we were riding those good feelings about his breakout. But I don't feel too bad about being wrong about this.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, I think that he was having such a good season. He ended up so close to that number. And, you know, you think about what a 7 WAR player looks and feels like, and that's kind of the level that Vladdy got to. Is, you know, you're an MVP candidate at that point. You're one of the best players in baseball. And I think even if he didn't get to the 7 WAR, he certainly put himself in that category of just being one of the elite players in baseball. And so in that sense, I think probably a fair call on all of our parts to take the over there.
The last one in the Vladdy category has not been resolved yet, but I'm going to take a victory lap for it in advance. It was MVP voting 2.5, meaning if you took the over, you thought he would be third or worse. And if you took the under, you thought he would be top two. Now, this has not occurred, but I feel confident that he's going to be top two. Maybe that's unfair. Yeah. Yeah. But I think that that's how it's going to go down. And I took the under, and both of you took the over. I think that, you know, we all saw Ohtani at that point in the season. We saw where that was going. So we baked all of that into our predictions. I think both of you guys sort of allowed for the opportunity of a Vladdy injury and also just someone else emerging in the race. And realistically, although Semien was fantastic, no one else really emerged in the race as the season went on. It was kind of Ohtani and Vladdy all year long.
Wow, yeah, that's a really interesting one. And I totally agree. I mean, we won't find out for another week and a half, 2 weeks, what the MVP ranking is. But you got to think Vladdy's second. I think it's almost a lock that he'll be second place there. So I think your victory lap is definitely well deserved there, Nick. It's a good call. And I mean, you know, you look at it, with Ohtani at the time being the clear favorite, then you're basically saying, is Vladdy going to maintain his position as the second best player in the American League? And he did that. So, I mean, it goes to show like what an incredible season this guy had from start to finish.
This one is interesting to me because, you know, we did like, it was just Vlad Ohtani for so long, the whole summer. And I don't know if you like by the end, Semien was right there. He could just as easily get it. I think, did Correa have a great year as well? I think if you look at the Baseball Reference WAR, he also was like above Vladdy, I think, by the end, or all sort of really grouped together. So, I think that it felt like the 1-2 was already like decided by September. And then when you kind of look at it at the end, maybe people will reassess a bit, but I still think, yeah, it's going to be Ohtani then Vlad.
Yeah, you could make that argument for a Correa or for a Semien, but a lot of that difference is going to be on defensive value, and I just think that voters in general tend to lean big, flashy offensive numbers, and there's no doubt, you know, Vladdy threatened for a triple crown at times. Obviously, he didn't finish there, but again, I'd be very surprised if I was wrong. If I was wrong, the total scoreboard's going to look pretty grim for me, because this was the one that I got that you guys didn't.
Yeah, I think you got this one. I it's really hard to imagine. And I didn't vote on MVP, or I didn't vote on anything this year. But I just think voters would look at the 48 home runs and the narrative. And this might have actually been part of your reasoning, Nick, at the time. But like the narrative of this 22-year-old doing this, like it is pretty juicy. I think it's kind of hard to resist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my narrative argument, because I listened back to it this morning before we recorded this podcast, was about the idea that he could be the player to tip the Blue Jays into the playoffs, because he was on the player on that team. Ouch. Right on the edge. Obviously, that didn't play out, but it very nearly played out. I still think Ohtani would win even if the Blue Jays had made the playoffs, but that's a whole different ballgame. So through three over-unders, we were a collective 2-for-9. So when I started listening to it this morning, I was like, oh man, we are going to eat a bunch of humble pie today. I will say to the listener, it gets better. But this is the low point for us, especially for Ben, who is sporting a hard 0-for-3. Ooh, out of the gate. Number four is an incredible line by me. You know, I'm just not even going to bother being humble about it. The line was George Springer game 78.5, and he played 78 on the dot.
Wow.
So come on, with the unpredictability of George Springer and the injuries in and out, I feel really good about that.
And there's like 10 or 15 of those he probably shouldn't have played, but
Yeah, I mean, oh, yeah, there's an argument for that. Yeah, that was part of our discussion, too, about how much DH time you would log and how Telez was on the way out, etc. Unfortunately, I didn't get to, you know, reap the benefits because we all set under on this and we were all very nearly right. I liked our logic was a lot about, you know, about injuries, about age, about the Blue Jays being inclined to rest guys and those DH at bats being open. And I think all of that basically came to fruition.
Now, so where was he in his recovery at that point? Was he back on the field yet?
I think he was, I think he had come back and now he was on his way back for the second time, but nearly back.
And so the line, where was the line set again?
78.5.
And we all took the under.
We all took the under.
So we just barely got this one right.
We barely got it right. If we got this wrong, again, our overall score would be, not ideal. But we all got it. We all figured, I think at the time it was just over 100 games left in the season, and he basically needed to play 75 or whatever it was, and we figured that he would do that, or he wouldn't quite do that, which is what happened.
And it is one of those things, like when you think about how much time he missed, right? Because that's basically half the season that he ended up playing. It really is one of those things that would have nudged the team over the top because he was worth, like, I don't know. I don't have the WAR in front of me here, but, you know, he was worth a few WAR for that half season. So if he plays even 40 more games, you got to think they're in the playoffs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And especially him at his best, right? Like if you look at his overall season long numbers, those don't reflect how well he was playing when he was fully healthy. Like a lot of that time is him sort of forcing it, for lack of a better term. And that kind of brings down his overall numbers. But when he was on, and not just on, when he was healthy, he was pretty incredible.
I think his numbers are still pretty good anyway. He's quite good, it turns out.
Yeah. My next over-under was by far my most controversial. I got texts about this from people afterwards. That was Julian Merriweather over-under 7.5 innings.
Oh, wow.
Which you two...
Your lines are pretty good here, yeah.
You two thought was a bit absurd, if to be honest. But you were all, I took the under. You guys were ultimately right. He did pitch 13 innings, but my thought was that we were barely going to see him again, or if we did, he would re-injure. And that's kind of how it played out. He did have setbacks for his oblique injury, and he barely made it back, but he made it back in enough time to crest the hill that is 7.5 innings, which in retrospect is actually a pretty stupid line because it doesn't reflect individual outs. Like 7.5 innings isn't a concept that exists. I guess if he had pitched 7.2 innings, that would have been an over, and 7.1 would have been an under. But anyway, poorly constructed on my part and wrong. At the same time, it was closer than maybe it should have been.
Man, I mean, you think about how good he looked at the beginning of the season you know, like closing games out. He was their closer in the first couple of weeks, and he looked like he belonged in that role. And then it just slid to the point that he just wasn't healthy. He wasn't someone they could rely on. And yeah, I mean, I think you're probably going to win a lot of over-unders, probably going to win a lot of bets taking the under on Julian Merriweather innings. And I hate to say it because, I mean, he can be a really fun pitcher to watch, but it's been such a challenge for him to get on the field and stay on the field really throughout his professional career.
Yeah, and also, I don't know, September didn't look quite like April.
No, yeah, very different.
Well, Ben, on the point of betting the under with Merriweather, you said at the time, if we had to bet his career innings, you'd have to bet under 100. Oh, and yeah. That's probably still valid, even though he racked up this heavy workload of 13 this year, which is a decent push towards the 100. But yeah, it's tough. It's really hard. I think a lot of people are kind of penciling him in as a useful bullpen piece for next year. And you just can't pencil him in for anything reality.
He's like, it's almost like when you sign, you know, and he has a roster spot, obviously, but it's almost reminiscent of like those minor league signings that teams make in spring training, you know, and you say, okay, let's see what he can do. And he shows up and if someone's healthy, great. You find a 40-man spot for him and you move ahead. But with Merriweather, You know, and I think they'll find ways to keep him on the 40-man, you know, especially with space coming up with so many free agents off the roster right now. But, you know, it is a little reminiscent of that, where you don't necessarily have a ton of confidence in what you're going to get.
Absolutely.
Well, you know, the 60-day IL always comes has in a handy. Place for him, yeah.
The next one is, this is a bit of a weird one, and it looks quite foolish in retrospect. I like a lot of the lines that I built here. This is the one that looks the stupidest. This was Robbie Ray's walks per nine, and the over-under was 3.33. And the idea was essentially, if you felt like his early season work was a bit fluky and he was going to regress, it would be over. And if you're buying into it, it was going to be under. That was kind of the math on it, the way it, because at the time it was in the twos. And I'm like, well, if it goes up to anything around four, he'll get over this. So it was a bit of a convoluted idea. The reality is at the end of the season, he was at 2.47. So it was way under this under because he never regressed in any way. And we all hit that. We all believed in Robbie Ray, at least from a strike throwing perspective. And we were all rewarded for that.
I assume that if you had asked it like 3 weeks earlier, we might have come up with different answers.
Yeah.
I don't know when the belief in Ray really clicked in, but I guess it was there by June or whenever we did this.
You know, I'm just bringing up his baseball reference page because I'm kind of following along here as you read these, Nick. And I am just seeing here, he led the American League in innings this year, which is just remarkable, you know, as well as ERA and strikeouts. Like, what a season he had. And I guess, you know, the 2.47 that he had this year, incredible season. Obviously, he's going to get paid for it, as he should. I wonder, like, if we were to move ahead into 2022, you got to think the walk rate's going up a little bit. You know, is 3.3 maybe a fair over-under for next year for Robbie Ray?
Yeah, I think you probably still take that under because I think there's something that's clicked with Ray. It's interesting you mentioned innings because at the time, Ben, one of the reasons you took this under is you felt like his innings load. And I mean, I guess I'm just absolutely sewering you here with a detail that I didn't really need to bring up. But I promise you, Ben, the moment after I sewer you, I will sewer myself far worse. So one of the reasons you took this under is because you felt like his innings load was going to come down, which meant that the first part of his season was going to be disproportionately relevant to his end of season stats.
Yeah.
So that's kind of silly. What's sillier is what I said, which was I could envision a scenario where Robbie Ray ends up as a bulk guy by the end of the season, which was based on the ascent of Manoa and the return of Nate Pearson, which that is ludicrous. And at the time, it was a bit of a hot take. It was just, insanity as it happens.
So even within this prediction where we're technically right, both of us were actually very wrong about the way that Robbie Ray would get there.
Yeah, I think Stoughton was more just on the ball in believing in it, and we were just kind of wriggling around.
Just being optimistic, really, you know, and somehow, other than not making the playoffs, the team did quite well this year. So that's all going to feed into any success I had here, I'm sure.
Well, so the next one here is I think the only one that Stoughton got wrong, but both of us got correct, Ben, which was Alek Manoah's ERA, which was set at 4.09. That number was sort of based on projections and brought down a little bit because I felt like we were all believers. He ended the season at 3.22, so this was not even close. Both you and I had the under. Stoughton had the over, which was a bit of a surprise because the early days of our podcast was absurdly Manoa heavy. And we were kind of pretty big Manoa evangelists, if not the biggest. So I don't know what prompted Stoughton to take the step back there. But believing in Manoa turns out is a good thing to do.
You know, you got to pump the brakes sometimes because, it was like every episode was Manoa for like a while there. Absolutely.
Yeah. The whole month of May, right? That was like a huge storyline. And it is.
That's when we started too. That our first episode was the very end of April, looking back at April. So that was, that was what gave birth to this podcast, was the Manoa hype.
Yeah. And this would have been like when we recorded these over-unders, this would have been right around the point that he's kind of emerging in the major leagues, right?
He was two starts in two at this time. In. He had one good. He had had the one really good start, the debut, and then the one questionable start the next time.
Yeah. So we weren't working with a ton of information here, and I mean, I guess the you know at that point though, you still would have been able to tell that he has a great fastball and that he attacks hitters, and I mean that really held up throughout the entire season. It was like an incredible rookie season. I think probably Rosarena wins Rookie of the Year, but I mean. Out of all the rookies in the American League, if you were to kind of project them going forward, and Wander Franco, obviously number one on that list, but if you were to project the rookies going forward, like Manoah's one of the guys that you would draft first if you were doing a draft of what rookies you'd want on your team going forward.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's nothing he did that you could really complain about. He had individual outings that were difficult and the command was spotty at times, but he blew away all expectations he possibly could have had for him. Developing.
Yeah, and a lot of those outings where he wasn't quite his best was able to pitch through it and do okay as well, which was, it's definitely a contrast because with say Nate Pearson, who, you know, has been the more hyped guy and obviously, when things would go off the rails for him, it has not gone as well.
So the final over-under was Marcus Semien WAR, which was at 6. We set it at 6. He was at about somewhere around 3 at the time. And we all picked under, and we were all incorrect. And it's interesting because Semien's a guy whose success was a little bit odd through a lot of the year. Like, he didn't have those big quality of contact numbers, but he had those big home run totals. And he seemed to... I don't know, game the system might not be the right terminology, but he seemed to find a way to yank those not particularly impressive, not particularly long home runs down the left field line in a way you sort of figured was going to end, and it just never did. He just kept doing it all year long.
Yeah, I mean, you would have thought that at a certain point, pitchers would realize that if he sees a fastball, he's going to turn on it and try to pull it and usually hit it over the wall. But I guess, I mean, they obviously would have known that, and he still kept doing it. So, I mean, I think this is one of the reasons when you look at that approach, along with great defense at second base, like, he's going to be in so much demand this offseason. And, you know, whether it's a team like the Jays, whether it's a team like the Mariners or the Giants or the Tigers or the Rangers, I think he's going to have so much interest. And, you know, 5-year deal, I think, is very much on the table and at a high AAV.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And it's weird, you know, I wrote about this like several weeks ago, but, you know, I love Marcus Semien. I love what he did this year. I would love to see him back with the Jays, but it is interesting how a lot of like the peripherals, like the strikeout walk rate or whatever, this year went right back to the levels where they were prior to his 2019. Where he had a really high walk rate and his strikeouts went way down. And the big difference, you know, between this year and his previous seasons was that all those balls went over the wall. And I'm like, that has given me pause a little bit on him. Not that I wouldn't, again, welcome him being signed to a very long contract. And clearly, like, when you hear the Jays, you know, Shapiro or Atkins or anybody talk about him, that you could hear the respect in their voices about, you know, what he is as a worker and a teammate and all that stuff that they love to laud. But yeah, it's interesting just because, like, as you say, Nick, like, he doesn't hit the ball particularly hard. Like, I think I went through the top home run guys or the guys who hit, you know, above 35 or something like that. And, you know, his average exit velocity was among the lowest. The profile just doesn't sort of fit as a guy who's going to hit 40 bombs every year.
Yeah.
And I think somebody's going to pay him like he is that guy.
Yeah.
And that's going to be it's going to be great for them. And also, I don't know if in the like narrow thinking about it in you know, from a GM's eyes kind of way, you're like, oh, is that the appropriate value? I'm not sure.
Well, he's one of those guys that's going to get all the points in the world for the leadership clubhouse guy intangibles as well. So I think that even if he doesn't maybe produce at the level his contract dictates, he's going to be a guy that people probably aren't going to regret signing.
Yeah,
I think that's fair too. Yeah,
agreed. And it's hard to see that his you know, like his production will drop off for sure. But I mean, if he becomes like a 30 to 35 homer, you know, 830 OPS, really good defense, gets you like four and a half, five war for the next 3 years, and then two war per season after that. Like, that's a really good player. He brings a lot to a team every day. Good base runner. Doesn't make a lot of mistakes, you know, like he's just a really good baseball
except for player. The one except I for the
one,
that's so unfair, people who hang that on him, but it is what it is. So anyway, over unders at the end of the day, we were all 4 for 8, which means that you don't actually have to listen to us talk ever. You can just flip a coin if you or get like a magic 8-ball or something. You'll get as much value. But before we stop raking ourselves over the coals here, the one other activity we did is we did a hot take I most believe is true. And we did 3 of these. So I'm just going to run through these relatively quickly. The first one, the 3 options I gave were A, Bo Bichette is not a long-term shortstop. B, we'll see Gabriel Moreno in 2021. And C, Charlie Montoyo limits this team's potential. And the way that one broke down is Stoughton took A, Bo Bichette is not a long-term shortstop, which...
Swing and a miss, I think.
Miss, I think, in terms of especially the way the Blue Jays see it. Definitely more defensible at the time. Ben, you took we'll see Gabriel Moreno in 2021, which is a swing and a miss. Yep. I took C, which is Charlie Montoyo limits this team's potential. That is just like a very big talking point that we'll never have a full resolution on. But I'll take
if you ask Twitter, you were correct.
Yeah, I'll take the ambiguity over the clear loss, right. I guess.
Yeah, not a clear win, but you didn't lose that one.
Yeah. Number 2, Reese McGuire is a better player than Danny Jansen was A. Wow. None of these were all out there in particular. B was Randall Grichuk's contract will end up being a steal. None of us fell for that trap, luckily. And C was Lourdes Gurriel Jr. is not a long-term starter for the Blue Jays. So I don't think any of these are correct now. Ben, you took Reese McGuire over Danny Jansen.
Ooh, that's incredible.
That's a tough one. I even at the time, to be honest, I didn't feel great about that one. The Gurriel Jr. is not a long-term starter for the Blue Jays. It depends how you massage those words. Like, there's a world in which they use him as a trade chip to kind of reallocate resources on the team. That one is still a little bit up in the air, but realistically, he came on so strong at the end of the year, and his contract is so good that it's hard to sit back on that take and feel good about it.
Yeah.
But it was what is most true. And I think that C is probably the most true of those, but it's not very true.
Yeah.
And so, Nick, you and I both took that one?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I mean, the Gurriel Jr. one, like, he certainly could be a long-term piece. Whether they trade him is another question, but he's hit well, and you know, he's obviously not a good defender, but he hit well enough to justify being a long-term player. He's a good hitter.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've had my doubts about Gurriel Jr. in the past, and he tends to find a way to smash those at the end of the day. The last one we did was... So the first one is Anthony Castro is the second best reliever in the Blue Jays bullpen. That is a moment in time, my friends.
Wow.
That is a moment in time. And it's also big time Nick Ashbourn bait. But I didn't actually take it. The second one is Nate Pearson will contribute less than 0.5 war in 2021. And then the third is the Blue Jays will make a serious run at Max Scherzer at the trade deadline. So B was literally accurate. His war was 0. Stoughton and I both picked that one. The C one, Blue Jays will make a serious run at Max Scherzer. Ben, you took that one. That wasn't accurate, but I will say that sort of the spirit of it was, in a sense, you know, in terms of Berríos being a top flight starter that they invested a bunch of prospect capital in acquiring at the deadline. I can't give you like perfect marks, but I do think there's something there.
Yeah, I don't feel bad about that one. Yeah, like that's not like a huge whiff, and I'm sure, you know, they, as you guys know, they check on everyone. So, you know, but serious run is a different thing than that. And we haven't been led to believe that there was a serious run. But getting Berríos, like, they were obviously a big player at the deadline in the starting pitching market. So that ended up being somewhat, yeah, as you say, directionally true.
Which is, when again, when it comes to predicting the future, that is about as good as you could hope. Literal accuracy is pretty hard to come by. It's funny how much Nate Pearson will contribute less than 0.5 WAR in 2021. Looking at it months later, it doesn't look like a hot take at all. No. You know what I mean? It's like, oh, of course that's how it would play out. But at the time, I think it really was. I think at the time there was an expectation that Pearson was going to come back and give this team quality innings for some amount of time. Or at the very, very least, be a very good reliever. And obviously he flashed being a very good reliever at times, but not consistently, and didn't give them many innings. But it kind of goes to show how rough the Nate Pearson experience was in 2021, that we had relatively modest expectations and he still fell pretty short of them.
Yeah. I mean, he's someone who, you know, you look at next year for Pearson and it's a huge year, right? Because like you could easily imagine he emerges as like Shane McClanahan, Luis Patino, like legit arm for the Jays. Or you could imagine that he's kind of sputters again. And at that point, I mean, if you know, it's really hard to put him in the category of important players on the team if he does sputter in 22.
Yeah, Ben, I wrote about and I listened to, of course, your talk with Atkins, and that was one thing that jumped out at me, is where he was like, whether he's in the majors or at AAA, and I'm just like, whoa, yeah. AAA for Pearson again.
Yeah.
But yeah, that could actually happen. Absolutely.
I mean, if that happens, it probably speaks to them acquiring some pretty decent starting pitching, which I guess is a good sign if you're a Blue Jays fan, yeah, but also, it's an assumption. Yeah. I think many of us have coming that they will get a good pitcher. Ben, I appreciate you coming on and reliving a very random moment in time with us. Like you said, I do think it's important. I mean, important would be a stretch. This is a Blue Jays podcast. But I do think that if you're going to have some credibility in the space, it is nice to revisit things that you've said in the past and hold yourself account to some degree. And, you know, we all came out as pretty mediocre, but that's okay. It wasn't disastrous. It could have been a lot worse, I think.
Well,
I'm moderately happy with these results.
It's nothing in any of our cases, I think, to go 4-for-8 when we all write about baseball, you know, professionally. It's nothing to be particularly proud of, but at the same time,
batting 500 here. Come on, boys. We nailed it.
It's not embarrassing. I mean,
it's not embarrassing.
And you know,
we did okay on the hot takes at the end too.
True, which is a little redeeming. And you look at some of the, like Jerry Krasnick, when he was still writing for ESPN, used to do these executive polls where the major league executives would make predictions.
And those guys
would be wrong all the time. Like it would happen. they would miss on all sorts of predictions. So that's,
granted, some of the executives at the time,
right. But I mean,
understandable.
Yeah, it's just hard to predict. And I think honestly, if we had given this to a member of the Jays coaching staff or a member of the Jays front office at the time, I don't think they would have been perfect either.
Better than us, I would guess, but probably not perfect.
It's tough to predict baseball. That's for sure.
All right, Ben, we appreciate you spending time with us. This is your second appearance on the show, which puts you in the all-time lead, and I think gives you best friend of the show status for now.
Amazing.
That'll be up in the air.
I'll hold on to it while I can. Always happy to join you guys, Stoughton and Nick, and thanks for having me on.
Yeah, thanks so much for being on with us, man.
And that was Ben Nicholson-Smith and us being approximately as good as a coin flip, as good as a magic eight ball. that's where we're at when it comes to baseball analysis. I hope that you guys have your eyes wide open about that going forward. I hope you will stick with the podcast nonetheless. We appreciate you guys listening in, subscribing, giving reviews, all the things that you do. We appreciate we are doing it for you, and we will get back to you next week.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.